It's all about reconciliation. I was very mindful of the Carroll household this week because of Emma's upcoming nuptials. Laura and I have been in that same boat twice. The topic of weddings had been front and center in our household about 5 years ago with Rachel's impending big day approaching. We booked the church, the reception hall. The lady said yes to the dress. Tuxes were ordered, flowers arranged, invitations were printed, the limo was booked, and Dad and Mother ended up being quite a bit poor in the end. In the end, though, it was a wonderful day. I wonder, though, if Emma and Nancy, maybe even Jim, have taken to watching TV shows they otherwise would never watch. Namely, in the television programs based on wedding themes. Shows like Four Weddings or the before-mentioned Yes to the Dress. And even shows about wedding cakes have now appeared on television. It's funny, isn't it, how so many television shows hold no interest for you until the subject matter of them matches your current situation, and then you tune them in. As a minister, though, my mind often thinks primarily of the ceremony itself. I think of all the details, like when is the rehearsal, what time is the rehearsal in the wedding, how late will the bride be, and who will be at the church to receive the flowers when they come? And will the photographer be an absolute nuisance? Now, that last one is quite critical, I kid you not. Many a photographer has ruined an otherwise beautiful and sacred ceremony. Stories abound, especially from ministers, of photographers taking flash photographs right in the minister's face, temporarily blinding him or her. Flash photographs also ruin the sacredness of the ceremony. I should add that normally when I do a ceremony inside the church, I ban them during the ceremony. Flash photographs ruin the sacredness of the ceremony as photographers run around the sanctuary. Why do they always wear those vests that look like they're in combat? Have you noticed that? They have those multi-pocketed vests. Grabbing that perfect angle. The late Reverend Ken Morrison told me once that he did a wedding, I kid you not, where right in the middle of the ceremony, the photographer popped up in the baptistry to get an important shot. I kid you not. I also get concerned about how nervous the couple will be on that day. I don't think Rachel and Jordan had too much trouble with their nerves on the big day. I don't think so. But many young couples do get quite nervous. One particular occasion, a minister was trying really hard to dispel the bride's nervousness at having to walk up the aisle in front of everybody for the ceremony. The minister suggested that she should calm herself. She should focus on familiar objects in the sanctuary. First, he told her, think of the aisle that you've walked up hundreds of times before. Then I want you to focus on the altar at the very front with the pretty flowers on it. And finally, think of George, your new groom. He'll be there waiting for you with a big smile on his face. On the wedding day, the congregation was surprised to hear the bride coming down the aisle muttering audibly, I'll alter George. I'll alter George. Ah, the glorious dream of every new bride to alter her husband. Yes. To hold that fantasy of molding him into the man she wants him to be. And sadly, how fleeting a dream it really is. I guess I really don't have to tell you this morning that relationships, and I mean all relationships, not just marriages, are fraught with all kinds of possible trouble. A poorly chosen word, a perceived slight of some kind, misread body language, or 100 other things, can all lead to trouble in our relationships. All of us in this room have been hurt in our relationships at some point or another. And yes, we've done some of the hurting too. In our gospel lesson today, Jesus is actually talking about relationships. I know it may be hard to see that, but what all these rules have to add up to are ways to preserve relationships and to prevent damage to them. What is also presented here by Jesus is a contrast between two views of the nature of evil. The first view of evil presented is the one we are most familiar with and probably understand the best. Evil is seen by most of us as a destructive action towards another human being, like murder. We get that. And as such, there are severe punishments for those kinds of actions, both in the courts and also in the afterlife. This is how we most often think of evil in this world. We may think of someone like 27-year-old Alexandra Bissonnette of Quebec, that he was being evil because of what he did, walking into a mosque and killing six Muslim men who were at prayer and wounding several others. There is no argument from Jesus that these kinds of actions, like that perpetrated by Mr. Bissonnette, are evil. Nor do I think there's any argument from any of us. What is different, however, about what Jesus teaches in this passage is that evil is not restricted to our actions. In taking the idea of evil one critical step further, Jesus is stating that evil most often resides where? In our hearts, our inner beings. Evil is still present even if we do not act out our inclinations. What Jesus is most concerned about is our disposition, our feelings towards each other. As an example, Jesus goes on to say, therefore, if you're angry at your brother, even if you do not physically harm him, you're still being evil. Now, frankly, that's a bit surprising, don't you think? At least I think it's surprising. I mean, what does it really matter what I think, as long as I don't act out of my anger? All of us have had dark thoughts about other people. Mrs. Graham, the wife of Dr. Billy Graham, was asked one time if she ever thought of divorcing her husband. In all honesty, she replied, not divorce. Murder, yes, but not divorce. The problem is that unresolved anger is just as damaging to our relationships as murder is. And damaging relationships is the very nature of evil. Killing someone permanently destroys a relationship. But you know what? So does anger. Out of anger, what do? We stop communicating. We all heard of the silent treatment. Out of anger, we avoid the one we're angry at. Out of anger, we might speak ill of someone. We might plot behind their back. We might wish them harm. And we can no longer show any affection or caring to them. Evil, by its nature, seeks to destroy relationship bonds that should unite us instead. Thinking of evil as destroying relationships is a really good template for understanding the rest of this passage and, frankly, most of Jesus' teaching. Consider further Jesus' words about calling someone a fool or cursing someone. Neither of these actions will win you any friends. The goal of Jesus' disciples is to make relationships, not destroy them. The reconciliation of strained relationships is to be the highest priority for Christ's followers. It takes precedence over everything else, including, as we see in this passage, even the worship of God. It takes precedence, reconciliation. So if you're standing at the altar in the temple, offering a sacrifice to God, and you suddenly remember that you've got something against someone else, leave your offering there and go and be reconciled. A person's anger towards us is not to be viewed as a reason to avoid reconciliation. I point out to you that according to Jesus, it is our responsibility to be reconciled to the other person. We are not to wait until they approach us. We are not to wait until they apologize to us. It is our primary responsibility as followers of Christ to mend fences, to restore relationships. Now, I know that these words, these commands of Jesus are really tough to implement. I know. I bet even this morning you are sitting there thinking about that one person that you just can't reconcile with. That one person who just constantly gets under your skin, makes your life miserable. We need to remember, though, that this is not about us. It's not about our feelings, but rather about the evil that is perpetrated by the fracturing of relationships. That's why not only is adultery wrong, but simply looking at someone lustfully is evil. Lust is the inner disposition that threatens a marriage. When we succumb to lust, we compare our spouse to another person. We're judging our spouse in comparison to another by finding faults or look-seeing perceived shortcomings. And when we do that, we build a wedge between us. You know, marriages never fail in one day. Never. They deteriorate over time. When resentment, anger, and unresolved issues cut deeper and deeper into the bonds that should bind the couple together. Same thing happens in many divorces, where the selfish pursuit of one or maybe even both partners severs the bond. The divorce is simply the end result of a long period of time of unreconciled differences, of evil that is left unchecked. And Jesus' point is that if anger, lust, divorce, calling someone a fool, ignoring someone who has something against you, all these things lay waste to the most important thing we have in life, relationships. Furthermore, Jesus is telling us that we have to take full responsibility for the health and vitality of our relationships. If something's not going right in your relationships, it's up to us to fix them. No matter how tempting it may be, we are not permitted the indulgence in our relationships to blame the other person. The primary issue is never whose fault is it. Rather, the primary importance is how quickly we can resolve the wedge that is between us. And in Jesus' words, the sooner the better. This idea of taking responsibility for relationships is explored by Jesus further in the next few verses. In the version we read today, the topic was on making vows. Did you notice that? In other versions of scriptural translation, the word is often rendered as swearing. Now, in this case, swearing has nothing to do with bad language. That's not what Jesus is talking about. It's got nothing to do with having a potty mouth at all. It actually refers to making an oath or taking a vow. And surprise, surprise, Jesus isn't talking about the courtroom. Lots of Christians out there who believe that he's talking about the courtroom where you get up and you swear to tell the truth. Because in the courtroom, you are making a promise for yourself. Jesus is referring to people who make promises based on someone or something else. Some modern examples might include, I swear on my mother's grave. Have you heard that before? Or, as God is my witness, I've heard. May lightning strike me down if I'm not telling the truth. Have you heard that one? How a couple of phrases children even use. Children say, pinky swear. Or, cross your heart and hope to die. Have you heard that one? There are many other examples of people swearing oaths in such a way, invoking someone or something else to give credence to what they say. The problem with doing that, with swearing like this, is it damages relationships. Swearing in this manner introduces someone or something else as a barrier to your relationship. Think about what this kind of swearing or oath-taking really means. Pay attention to how ridiculous it is. There is no way on earth we can control the other person on which we are swearing an oath on, least of all God. Swearing transforms an open, honest, frank relationship into an indirect one. By swearing, we are denying our own responsibility for our own truthfulness. And righteousness means taking responsibility for what we say or what we do. To avoid any evil or destruction of relationships, our statements need to stand on their own. When we invoke someone or something else in our oaths, we are immediately tipping the other person off that something's wrong. In the words of Shakespeare, me thinks thou doth protest too much. The stronger the attempt to assure truthfulness of what we say by invoking God or our mothers or whatever, the higher probability of falsehood. Just think back to the last time someone tried to assure you of their truthfulness in this way, by swearing on something else. Did you not feel uncomfortable? Did the swearing make you feel more assured of your relationship of trust with that other person? So let your yes be yes, and your no, no. Our statements should stand on their own merit, and we should demonstrate that our will is our own. If people cannot trust us, or our word on its own, without invoking some outside support, then our relationships are doomed. They're evil. Do you understand what Jesus is telling us? Evil is perpetrated in the heart, long before we hear about it in the news. The damage that murder or adultery causes began a lot earlier with anger and lust. Jesus wants us to nip it all in the bud, to get at it while it's still just festering inside. To accomplish this, Jesus makes what seems like a very harsh command, and frightening actually. If your eye causes you to lust, gouge it out, throw it away. If your hand, even your stronger hand, that would be my right, causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. These frightening words make it sound as if Jesus is somehow promoting self-mutilation as a way to combat evil. However, we got to remember that Jesus is using the rabbinical teaching method. You exaggerate to the extreme the point you're trying to make. The Sadducees in Luke 20 used the same approach. When they came to Jesus to talk about the resurrection, remember that ridiculous story about a woman who had seven brothers as a husband, whose husband would, or whose wife would she be in the afterlife? Remember that? That's rabbinical teaching. Exaggeration. Jesus' point is this: whatever situation puts you at greater chance to sin, in this case, harm your relationship, avoid them. Cut them out of your life. If alcohol is hurting your relationship, don't go to a bar. If you spend hours watching pornography on your computer, harming how you think about your wife, put a filter on your system or put your computer in a public, well-accessed area. If someone makes you so angry that you fantasize about them being harmed in some way, start praying. It's also advisable to avoid those situations with that person that triggers your anger. You know, it's really hard to stay angry at someone if you're praying for them. Jesus expresses what our response to difficult people should be in the next few verses. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. We do, however, need to be sincere in our prayers and our efforts. We don't want to be like the man who was having trouble losing weight and was trying to avoid sweets. One day he reported to a friend that he was driving and he was very tempted to stop and get a donut at the local Tim Hortons or whatever. He therefore prayed, "Dear Lord, if you want me to stop and have a donut, show me a sign by having an open parking spot in front of the shop waiting for me." And his friend asked, "Did your prayer work?" The man replied, "Well, it took 5 trips around the block, but sure enough, a parking spot opened up." This passage from Matthew is all about relationships. It's about how we preserve and strengthen, heal, and reconcile fractured relationships. It is all about how we avoid the evil we perpetrate in this world by damaging our relationships. Because we all know that damaged relationships, well, they have a tendency to spread, don't they? If a father and mother have a damaged relationship, the kids suffer. A parent has a damaged relationship with a grown child, the extended family pays the price. 2 coworkers who cannot get along in the office, and what happens? Productivity and company morale, they just plummet. Issues like poverty, injustice, political differences that divide people, and that leads to what? To clashes in the street. A society torn in two. Just look what's happening south of the border. Our highest calling as God's people is to what? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Our highest calling, therefore, is relationships. Healthy, good relationships. If we thought long and hard enough about it, I think we can trace just about all of humanity's troubles back to fractured relationships. If we want better homes, better churches, better schools, better workplaces, better neighborhoods, then we better root out the evil where it manifests itself. And according to Jesus, the place it manifests itself is where? Right here. In our hearts. So let's you and I commit ourselves. Commit ourselves to guarding our hearts, our marriages, our friendships, our families, so that we can all have no regrets when we stand before God.